Last time we met, we were in chapter 7 of the Gospel according to Mark. And as time ran out and then passed, and we were still going. As we were ending up, we had been talking about Jesus challenging false views of holiness, especially with some of the Pharisaic practices and those kinds of things, and the loopholes that they put in. And then he talked about what counts as holiness and righteousness before God, not just the rote kinds of rituals and other things, but rather our intentions and our assistance with others. We find after that, we had gotten through verse 23. Starting in verse 24, we find him going to the area of Tyre and Sidon. Tyre and Sidon were predominantly Gentile areas. And he goes into a house and tried to sneak in. Didn't want anybody to know that he was there. Just wanted some downtime, I guess, with his disciples and that kind of thing. However, once again, one of Mark's favorite words, immediately somebody knew he was there. And it wasn't a somebody that you would expect Jesus' disciples and certainly not the Pharisees to care about. This is a story of the Syrophoenician woman whose daughter was ill and possessed by an unclean spirit. Tyre had been an island until Alexander the Great defeated it in 322 B.C. And he used the ruins of Tyre, of the cities there and everything, he used that actually to fill in the waterway and build a causeway to go across. So all the buildings that were destroyed and torn down when he conquered it, in order to more and more humiliate the people that were there and that he had defeated who thought they were so grand and wonderful, he took those buildings and had his men fill in the water to make a road to go over to the mainland there with Tyre. Tyre was known for its economic standing, and in the time of Jesus it was well known for its economic standing. However, there was no place for them to grow their own crops, so all the produce they had to import and take from the Jews. Tyre was, once again, predominantly a Gentile city. Take from the Jews that were just across the way on the mainland, and they would buy up, Tyre would buy up bread and produce, all kinds of things in excess, which then made things more scarce for the Jews there. In Galilee. In fact, one of the complaints about them is they bought the bread off the very tables of the Jews, so that there was barely enough to go around.
Well,
well, it was the merchants would sell it, which means the other folks couldn't buy it because it wasn't there. Yeah, it was a shortage. And that's part of the reason why the Jews resented the people in Tyre and Sidon so much that they referred to them, you know, they referred to Samaritans as dogs, but they also referred to the Gentiles in Tyre as dogs. In fact, they referred to them as, wild dogs. Not domesticated, but wild dogs. Just ravaging and taking whatever they wanted. I guess they could have called them coyotes and that would have worked too. Right? But here we've got this Syrophoenician woman then that comes in. She is a Gentile from southern Syria. And in one of the other Gospels, we're just told she's a Canaanite woman in Matthew, that she's a Canaanite woman. But here the Syrophoenician gives even more of this sense of hatred and degradation of this person, of this woman. The Syrophoenicians were not only considered dogs, but they were considered money grubbers. And they were among the lower dogs. They weren't the high class dogs, they were the lower dogs. In the view of the Gentiles. And that's D-O-G-S, not D-A-W-G-S. And so, but this woman immediately finds out that Jesus is there. And for the writer of the Gospel of Mark, she finds out because there is this spiritual battle that's still going on. Remember earlier we talked about Jesus' power over demons and how the demons were constantly there and butting heads against Jesus and trying to drag him down or let him be known. And so for the writer of Mark, the fact that this woman's daughter has an unclean spirit and she immediately, when Jesus sneaks into town and sneaks into the house, she immediately knows he's there is because of the, once again, you still got this undercurrent of Jesus and the demonic, Jesus and the evil ones. And so she comes and while she's there, she falls down at his feet, a sign of extreme humility. Of course, Jesus looks at her, and as she's begging to cast the demon out of her daughter, Jesus says, "Let the children first be fed. It's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Now, this is one of those places where some people think Jesus was being heartless, that he was being heartless. In fact, the word here for dog is like a yard dog. Okay. One of my friends used to sometimes tell his son when he was in high school, if he didn't watch out, he's going to beat him like a yard dog. But, you know, so undisciplined. So Jesus actually uses the term here for dog for yard dog. One that's undisciplined and unruly. Her response, though, and what he was saying is, you know, his ministry was initially to the Jews. You know, he was saying, "I'm here for the Jews first." So is it, and it's not, and when he says it is not right, it can also be posed as a question. And in a Greek text, it can be either way. I see it more as a question. He's not saying, "No, it's not right for me to do that," but is it not right or is it not proper that first I tell the children before feeding the dogs? Because, I mean, what happens? The children come and eat at the table. Of course, then, as we said last time, the dogs hang around under the table because they, you know, you dipped once, and if you didn't eat the whole piece of bread, you didn't dip a second time because it spread germs. You threw it on the floor. And you hope the dogs were there to clean it up. Okay? And so he's dealing with this, but he's also, I think, prodding some at what the disciples have just witnessed with the Pharisees. And so he says, is it really proper? Is it really right for me to take this and give it to the yard dogs? At which point the woman looks at him and says, "I'm not asking for everything." She said, "No, I'm just asking for the crumbs. Isn't there something left over for the house dogs?" In fact, the word she uses is the dog for a, is the word for a domesticated, a small domesticated house dog. I don't know if that's like, I don't know if y'all saw this morning or not, but right before we left, the Today Show had come on. And one of the high, they were doing highs and lows, is one of them, some French, little French dog. Yeah, French bulldog. And every time, 2 years old, every time he walked past a mirror, he whirled around and he started dancing around and barking and jumping at the dog that was in the mirror. And he didn't have a clue that it was a different dog. So maybe he's talking about little French bulldogs. But her response was, "I'm not," you know, when she says, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." You know, she's saying, "I'm just asking for a little consideration here, a little bit that's left over, not for the whole thing." Yes.
Why aren't the yard dogs in the house to start
with? Why aren't the yard?
If they were getting stuff off the table.
Not the yard dogs. The yard dogs stay outside. This is the domesticated dogs inside that eat, get the crumbs off the table. Like the little French bulldog. Well, we had a Chihuahua Manchester when I was growing up. His name was Rusty. We got him when I was in the sixth grade. And I don't know why. Rusty didn't treat many people this way, but every time Jack Clark, who was a preacher, showed up, Rusty was all at his ankles, and he'd go sit on the couch and Rusty would jump up and lay down about that far away from him and watch him. And if he so much as shifted, he'd turn and bark at him and bare his teeth. And when he'd go to leave, he'd, all the way to the door, he'd follow.
He ain't like freaking.
Didn't know why that was. You know, why? How he figured that out.
Well,
Shirley MacLaine. Yeah, the little dogs, that's the Greek word that's used there is for the little dog, the house dog. Of course, Rusty bit me one time and I pinched his skin up and bit him and he yelped. He never bit me again and he lived to be 19 years old and he'd growl and I'd put my hand in his teeth but he wouldn't bite. He'd want to bite but I guess he remembered that I bit him back. So. But, she shows a great deal of faith. In fact, Jesus says to her, for her continuing on to ask, he said to her, for this saying, you may go your way, the demon has left your daughter. Now, in the Gospel of Matthew, the same story, in that story, he says that he hasn't found that kind of faith among the children of Israel. But once again, in the Gospels, here he's healing her, and he's showing his power not only over the demons present, but over evil in general in the world, because he heals this woman's daughter from a distance. And I'm not going to sing a Bette Midler song. He heals this daughter from a distance. And now that song's going to be in your head all night long, Kitty.
Right.
But because of what? Because of her faith. Remember we said in the Gospel of Mark in particular, in Mark, Matthew, and Luke in general, but especially in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus never ever heal somebody to get them to have faith in him. He only heals in response to somebody's faith. Now, they don't understand the full ramifications of that faith because they don't understand everything about Jesus at this point, but they know that he can do something. He has come from God. It's just like the men who bring the friend who's been paralyzed and drop him through the guy's roof. They have shown faith, and the guy shows faith by getting up. We heard that kind of music when we were in Jamaica at the spa.
But a lot of these healings are juxtaposed against the disciples who constantly are berating
mm-hmm.
as little faith.
That's right, Susan. They don't have that kind of faith, and they don't really understand. And they're with him, and he berates them because you're with me, you see all these things, and you see stuff behind the scenes, and yet you still don't have that faith and you still don't understand. In fact, in Mark, there have been a number of scholars who have noted this. I think it's obvious. In Mark, the writer of the Gospel of Mark shows the disciples to be very inept, lacking in faith. In fact, they're very much like the Hebrews in the book of Numbers who were faithless and rebellious, they're spiritually blind. And so in the Gospel of Mark especially, we find the disciples are being very inept, not being very perceptive, and lacking in faith. And yet, in spite of that, Jesus continues to work with them and work with them and work with them until ultimately they end up helping to spread the good news and grow the church. Which also indicates that if to his readers they may feel in Nero's Rome and being persecuted, that they're totally inept and they're totally worthless and they really can't do anything. And yet he's trying to show them that Jesus, even Peter, who had perpetual foot and mouth disease, sometimes he only opened his mouth to rearrange his feet. Even with that, God continued to work and work and bring them along and work through them in spite of their ineptitude, in spite of their faithlessness. And that's part of the encouragement he's trying to give to them, especially in those difficult days where they don't know if they're going to live or die in the next 10 minutes. And so the woman then goes, she went home, and guess what? The demon's gone, and her daughter's lying there in bed sound asleep. Everything's fine. So it does juxtapose, as you said, Susan, against that, but it also continues to show throughout Mark there is this spiritual undercurrent. There's a constant battle going on between the forces of evil and the forces of God in Jesus. And so here he doesn't even have to be present to cast the demons out. He could just by a word, long distance, that takes place.
What do you think the Syrian woman did after?
The Syrophoenician woman?
What did she think Jesus was the Messiah?
Oh, she just knew that Jesus had a connection with God that seemed to be deeper than anybody else she had ever seen. She had heard of his healings, and she's not asking for herself, she's asking for her daughter. She's not even Jewish. So she's not a practitioner of Judaism. She doesn't see him as Messiah. She sees him as someone who can help her daughter and can potentially work miracles.
And what an encouragement it is for every parent who's ever prayed for a child.
Mm-hmm.
That Christ would heal them or change their hearts. To know that that can be done without them even present.
Right.
Being in the human state, do you think she surprises him with her, or is he testing her?
Quite frankly, I think she caught him off guard to begin with.
Yes, sir.
And I think that's also part of his question. She caught him off guard, and so, okay, what are you really after? She's really after her daughter, and she persists, given the fact, A, she's a woman in that society, B, she is a Syrophoenician woman in that society, and Jesus challenges her. It's also to see how she's going to react. She stands up for her daughter, and, you know, it's not like she gets all in his face, but she stands up for her daughter, whereas probably a lot of the women, if not most of them then, would have turned and wandered out.
See, devil, one, two, three, one. Gone, one, two, three, four. Yes, yes.
The devil left. Are you talking about the woman who had the seven demons that was cast out? Or are you talking about the devil leaving, or the demons leaving out of multiple people?
Yeah.
And, you know, but that would not every time be seen as the devil leaving, but minions, that is demons, minions of the devil. Yet each time one of the devil's minions is defeated, it diminishes his authority and his power. And that kind of thing. So, I mean, they thought there were demons everywhere and inside of people and that kind of stuff. All this space between us was filled with angels and demons and spirits. So much so, as we've said several times before, so much so that one of the beliefs in the ancient world then was that you could not, even among the early Christians, that you couldn't stick a pin in the air without hitting one. So they're all over the place. So somebody claps you on the back and you go, you better be careful, you might just suck one of those things in, right? But no, Ariel, she would not have seen him as Messiah. She saw him as a great miracle worker that had some connection with God. Well, we don't know what happened to her. It's just like, yeah.
It just seems so ironic for someone to have that kind of faith and the fact that they remembered her. It seems to me that she would have something special.
Well, and we would hope that perhaps after this, that she maybe began following Jesus more and more, and at some point she became a follower of the way, but we really don't know. It's just like we don't know what happened with the rich young ruler. It says he went away sorrowful. Okay, well, and Jesus said it's harder for a rich man to get into heaven than a camel to go through the eye of a needle. But we don't know what happened. Was he going away sorrowful because he wasn't going to give it up? Or was he going away sorrowful because he was going to give it up? We don't know. Nothing ever says what happened to him. But Jesus made a different, you know, made his point with all of that. So, you know, our hope is that perhaps she did, but we really don't know. Then he leaves, and in this part, most of Jesus' ministry in the Gospel of Mark takes place in the northern part of the kingdom. Tyre, Sidon, Decapolis, Galilee. He's back and forth, bounces back and forth across different parts of the Sea of Galilee and different regions that border those parts of the Sea of Galilee. So he returned from Tyre and Sidon. From Tyre, went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee through the region of the Decapolis. Once again, so all of this is taking place. In fact, if all we had to go on was the Gospel of Mark, you could condense Jesus' ministry instead of 3 years in 6 to 9 months. Because he's up in that area and just back and forth and back and forth. Luke helps us understand that it was longer. John gives us 3 Passovers that show us it was a 3-year ministry. But then again, Mark is writing in a very difficult time. He's writing a very fast-paced gospel. So, you know, he's not recording all, you know, anything in length of time. He's trying to give his readers these understandings of what Jesus did, how Jesus did it, the disciples, how they reacted. Now, how are you going to react? I mean, you've got the disciples reacting one way and they're kind of duh, and you've got this Syrophoenician woman who's not even Jewish and doesn't even worship Yahweh who comes to him and shows great faith. So, you know, people who we sometimes seem to put outside sometimes are really more inside than folks who are so pious that they think they're the chosen ones. And that's also part of what goes on here. So he goes, and they brought to him a man who was deaf and had an impediment in speech. Some of the translations say he was deaf and dumb. That is, he can't talk, can't verbalize things. And they sought him to lay his hand upon him. And taking him aside from the multitude privately, he put his fingers in his ears and spat and touched his tongue. Looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephatha, that is, be opened. And his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. Okay? Now, in fact, when it says he looked to heaven and he sighed, the particular word is a deep prayer sigh. A deep sigh of prayer is what he does as he looks to heaven, to God the Father. And he says, Ephatha, that is, be opened. Now, for some reason, don't know why, in the ancient world, they thought spit, especially of a holy man, that spit had some kind of quality to heal. You recall that the man, that he puts the mud on his eyes and he sees partially and then does again. What does he do? He spits in the dirt and makes little mud pies and puts them on his eyes. So there was this idea, especially a holy man, that holy man, there was something special about him and that even his spittle. So here, he's not spitting on him because he's mad or spitting on him because he thinks he's lowly. The spit is part of the healing process here. And so the man does, and he charges them to tell no one. He tells the disciples, don't tell anybody. He tells this man, he takes the man aside privately to heal him and then says, don't tell anybody what happened. Don't tell anybody who did this. Which is part of that whole messianic secret thing. But the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it, and they were astonished beyond measure. So as word spreads, people start coming, and they check on this guy, and the guys that they know, he's been deaf and dumb, he can hear them, and he can talk plainly, and so they're astonished, and so they begin spreading this word that he has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the dumb speak. Jesus, what we find here is that Jesus doesn't just, even though he tells him don't do this yet, because he doesn't want to be seen just as another miracle worker or have to literally play Caesar's palace or whatever. But in part, he's trying to say, you need to be ready. And what we have here in the fact that they continually say it, Jesus, as Alan Culpepper says, Jesus opens the eyes, the ears, and the mouths of people so that they can tell the good news, so that they can spread the good news, which is a challenge to his hearers. and his readers, Mark's readers. You know, you want to hole up because the Romans are going to get you? Well, no, you hadn't been saved so that you can go into hiding. You've been saved so that you can spread the good news. And if it means you lose your life, so be it. Just lose it in a proper fashion so that that good news and that grace is seen, even in what you say and what you do and those kinds of things. Then we come to this really kind of a pivotal chapter, chapter 8 in the Gospel of Mark. Chapter 8 in the Gospel of Mark contains a number of things. It contains the feeding of the 4,000. So this is a second feeding. And just like earlier in the text, where you had the feeding of the 5,000, there's the feeding of the 4,000. After the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus and disciples crossed the sea. Guess what? After the feeding of the 4,000, they crossed the sea. Then next there was controversy in chapter 6. There was controversy about defilement, not washing your hands when you eat. Chapter 8, there's controversy about signs. The Pharisees want, well, if you really are from God, we want a sign from heaven. Yeah, because that was real big for them, is signs and wonders and that kind of thing. We got the Syrophoenician woman and the bread. We're going to find in chapter 8, there's the mystery of the loaves and the leaven of Pharisees. Also in the Gospel of John, chapter 6, Peter confesses Jesus and they want to make him king, but he leaves. In chapter 8, we have that critical confession that everybody repeats, and most people repeat it, Peter's confession of Jesus. Who do men say that I am? Well, who do you say that I am? Most everybody quotes Matthew, not Mark. In Mark, he simply says, I think you're the Messiah. And the text says, and Jesus charged them not to tell anybody. In the Gospel of Matthew, it's expanded. I say you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. At which point in time, Jesus then makes Simon Peter the rock upon which the church is built and that kind of thing. And then he begins in John chapter 6 to tell them about his passion that's upcoming. In Mark chapter 8, as soon as Peter does this, and he tells them to be quiet, then what does he do? He starts teaching them that he's going to go and suffer and die. At which point Simon Peter rebukes him. So this is really a crucial chapter. And it's a chapter where Jesus does these things and all of a sudden, finally, the disciples say, we get it. You're the Messiah. And Jesus says, don't tell anybody. Why? Because while they get he is Messiah on one level, they don't get what that really means. They're still thinking earthly political ruler. And had Jesus allowed them to do that, the real question is, if Jesus allowed it to run out and start telling everybody, he's a Messiah, he's a Messiah, he's a Messiah, we know it, we've seen it, he's a Messiah, with their emphasis on an earthly political king, what do you think the Romans would have done? A whole lot sooner than they eventually did. Except they might not have crucified him. They might have shot him through with an arrow or skewered him on a spear and slaughtered his disciples along with him.
But the Romans really didn't care. It was just
Herod
that cared.
Well, the Romans, yeah.
Well, you're right.
In one respect, Susan, he washed his hands of it because he didn't see. They were pushing him for treason, and he didn't see it as treason because he said he's not going to have a kingdom down here. He's already said it's not going to be down here. But the Roman Caesar would have, had they told Caesar, look, this guy's claiming to be a king. That's sedition, that's treason, and that's a capital offense. Pontius Pilate would have been in trouble for not taking care of it. So on the one hand, the Romans do care about it because if there's an uprising like that, an attempt to overthrow them with them declaring him as king, they would care.
Not king of anybody else, not king of the Gentiles.
Well, he calls them king of the Jews. They say, no, he's claiming to be king, period. That's what the charge when they bring him up. And in Luke, the charges are causing riots, getting the people to riot, forbidding taxes to Caesar, which he doesn't, and claiming to be a king. Not king of the Jews, but king and overthrow the Romans, run the Romans out. So while Pilate really, he's ticked off with them. That's why he has a sign put up, King of the Jews, because it irritates the Sanhedrin to no end. And they say, he's not our king. Yeah, take that down. He said, no, I've written what I've written. And then he dares them to do something about it. So that was, so you got that ongoing episode, mini episode within the larger soap opera. They pay the taxes. They can have the Sanhedrin for
and the temple. They can make all
for religious kinds of reasons, yeah. But they can't. They don't allow them to put any kind of major penalties. They can't put a man to death in spite of the laws and all. But they would see him.
Didn't want to be Roman.
Oh no, they didn't. They didn't. And that's why the zealots really pushed and pushed and pushed. They wanted somebody. And I honestly, and that and the dog gets a drink, the drink machine or whatever they cost. I honestly believe that the primary reason Judas betrayed Jesus had nothing to do with the money. I think he was a zealot from Kerioth who thought he had found that Messiah. And when Jesus starts to back out, he gets angry and he gets upset and he says, I know you're the Messiah, and by golly, I'm going to put you in a position where you have to prove it. And then he had a selfish motive too. If he's Jesus' right-hand man, if he pushes it to that and Jesus overthrows a Roman, he's the right-hand man, he's the one that brought it to be, he can become the general.
Don't you think it was because he, like the others, didn't really understand?
Well, he didn't. And I think when he, I don't think Judas, and once again, whatever, costs to get a drink, but in my personal opinion, I don't think that Judas ever intended for Jesus to die. And when he found out Jesus was going to die, he tries to buy him back. And when he can't buy him back, he doesn't even take the money and go drown his sorrows. He can't handle it. He can't live with himself. And so basically when he hangs himself, he's going to throw himself on the mercy of God.
One who wrote the book, they said they bowed by Judas, the book of Judas, whatever, he said he was chosen to be the one betrayed.
That's, you know, there were a lot of things written with people's names on them that didn't, that weren't written by them.
I agree with that.
It's just like the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs supposedly was written in the pseudepigraph. It was supposedly written by all the different 12 Patriarchs. No, it doesn't show up till long after they're dead. They'd literally have to be ghostwriters. So, yeah. So this is really a rather strategic chapter, especially since Jesus does more ministry among Gentiles in this section of Mark. And who is Mark writing to? Predominantly Gentile Christians who are being persecuted in the Rose Run. And so they're saying, look, Jesus came here for you guys too, and he stood with them here and ministered to them. Now he's standing with you here and ministering to you as well. Now the feeding of the multitude is the only miracle of Jesus that is in all four Gospels. Whether it's 5,000 or 4,000 or both, Jesus feeding the multitude with loaves or loaves and fishes is the only miracle of Jesus that's in all four Gospels. As my friend Culpepper writes, in these cycles, we have the earliest core of the gospel tradition regarding Jesus' ministry in Galilee. And significantly, they are informed by the Exodus motif with feeding in the wilderness, crossing the sea, and salvation from God. End quote. So what we've got here, too, is reflective of this and also reminds Mark's readers, this is the same God. It's not a different God. It's the same God in Jesus that led the children of Israel through the wilderness, fed them manna in the wilderness, which was probably insect secretions, but you know, we call it bread from heaven. And then they crossed the sea and they crossed the Jordan River, salvation from God. Here, they're in the wilderness. That area is considered wilderness area. They're in the wilderness. Jesus feeds the multitudes with bread miraculously and offers them salvation. And he and the disciples cross the sea. So it's also a reminder that it's the same God in the Old Testament that you've got here in Jesus. They're not two separate gods, not multiple deities. It's the same God who oversees not just the Jews, but the Gentiles as well. There's only one who created, who rescued, and who continues to rescue in and through Jesus. That's my little addition to Alan's stuff. Now here we find in those days, when again a great crowd had gathered and they had nothing to eat, he called the disciples and said to them, I have compassion on this crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. These are Gentiles who have been following him, not Jews, but Gentiles. They've had no food, and when he says they have had no food or they have no food to eat, they've had very little and now they're out. Now they're out. The 3 days also reminds the readers of the passion traditions, crucifixion to resurrection. Death of old, resurrection to new. And when it says, literally, my text reads, they have been with me for 3 days, but literally it means they have continued with me for 3 days. They could have left at any time. In fact, they were given opportunities to leave, but they didn't even go home and sleep. They stayed with Jesus. They stayed with the disciples to spend all of that time with him. And so he has compassion on them. He says they have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry, they will faint along the way. The word for faint here is also the word that sometimes uses to fall away from the faith. So if I send them home, you know, they'll faint. Well, they'll also fall away from what they've learned. Which, for Mark's readers, again, you're in the middle of all of this. Are you going to fall? Are you going to faint and fall away in Roman persecution? Or are you going to stay with Jesus? Have you grown weak, or you stay the course? And some of them have come a long way. You know, the Gentiles were seen as being far off spiritually as well. So they've come a long way to be with him. And so they said, how can we feed these men with bread in the desert? And he said, how many loaves do you have? And they said, seven. Note, seven loaves. Loaves and fishes are separated here, but seven loaves. Seven is the number of wholeness, the number of completion here. And so we find he commanded the crowd to sit down. He took the seven loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. And they set them before the crowd, and they had a few small fish. And having blessed them, he commanded these also should be set before them. And they ate and were satisfied, and they took up the broken pieces left over, seven baskets full. And there were about 4,000 people. And he sent them away, and immediately he got in the boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. Jesus gave thanks for the bread. The word used here, eucharistasis, is the same word that we read this morning. And the same word that you read at the Last Supper when it says, and he gave thanks over the bread, a blessing over the bread, eucharistasis. And so Jesus gives this thanks to God for the bread and then distributes the bread. He doesn't keep it for himself. Jesus feeds these 4,000, and then what does he do? He's given them not only physical bread, but for 3 days he's given them his teachings. And then the text says he sends them on their way to do what? To tell other people about what they've received. Tell other people about what they've received. To give that good news of the kingdom. Not as much fanfare as the feeding of the 5,000, but satisfaction of the need. Once again, you're in time of persecution or you're in time of crisis now, and Jesus is present to give you what you need. Notice he does. They eat until they're satisfied, but he doesn't overfill them. He gives them what they need. Jesus provides for our needs. And then he leaves and goes to the district of Dalmanutha. This is the only place in the whole Bible where Dalmanutha is mentioned, and we really don't know where it is except somewhere along the Sea of Galilee. But it too is a Gentile area. It's interesting that when Jesus is on the western side of the Sea of Galilee, he's among Jews. Anytime he goes to the eastern side or the northeastern side, he's among Gentiles. And so all this ministry goes back and forth, back and forth. The other thing to note here is that all along the Sea of Galilee, you've got a conglomeration of all kinds of groups, Gentiles and Jews. Jesus doesn't minister just to one. Jesus ministers to all, back and forth. So with this whole cosmopolitan thing and all of these different groups around, Jesus is not here just to call a select few. Jesus is here to call all and to minister to all. And it's our responsibility then in how we respond and what we do with it. And it's 6:45. I'm at a stopping point. Ed. But we will pick up there and finish out chapter 8. We will pick up starting in verse 11. Because the Pharisees come and start arguing with him. Okay. No. Not as much. And when he does, he summarizes it. Well, thank you all. Be careful this evening. God bless you. Go in peace. And I hope to see you, if not four, on Wednesday at supper.